Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on You Can Beat City Hall when we come back. You know, in real estate transactions, we follow these three rules. It's called location, location, and location. Well, in criminal law, we follow three rules when we're talking to the police or government agents. And that is, don't say anything, keep your mouth shut, and then shut up. Knowing what to say and when to say it and what not to say and who not to say it to is summed up in this maxim of law, which says that all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. And that's why judges in their opinions make these kinds of short, terse statements. Listen to this. The first judge said, "Who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights?" He said that in U.S. versus Dickerson. Now, you know, if I said something like that, I'd be accused of being a tax protester or something. Well, listen to the second judge. He said, "You can and you must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment." That comes from Belknap versus United States. Now, you know, if I said something like that, I'd be accused of obstructing justice or something like it. Listen to the third judge. He said, "The constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent, as well as to protect the innocent and farsighted." And he said that in Marchetti versus United States. Now, if you'd like more information on courtroom strategy and procedure, then call the law school at area code 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and remember, it's free of charge. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and then send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. That's georgegordon.org or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, talking about this thing of you can beat City Hall comes in many forms. Ostensibly, what we want to do is to beat a bureaucrat at his own game. We want to beat some government official. And we want to take the law and stick it up his hiney sideways. That's our objective. Everybody dreams of doing that. And we do it in little minor ways. I mentioned last time that there's a new scheme that the government is using, that his city governments are putting. They're putting cameras up at busy intersections so that they can photograph your car as it goes through the yellow light. And when the yellow light turns to red and you're still in the middle of the intersection, it isn't that you ran the red light. It was orange when you entered the intersection. That used to be the old rule, but not anymore. Now, if they can catch your car in the intersection with the red light on, they take a photograph of it, and then they say, okay, well, you ran the red light. It has nothing to do with health, safety, and welfare of the public. It has everything to do with revenue generation. So some enterprising fellow comes along, and he's now selling a plastic cover that covers your license plate. Now, you know, with your normal vision, you can look through the clear plastic, and you can read the license plate number, so it complies with all the laws. But when you photograph it, there's something about this plastic or some chemical film that's over it, that when you photograph it, it turns out black. It's like reading Mad Magazine and Spy versus Spy. See, the government comes up with this neat program for enhanced revenue generation, and then some enterprising inventor comes along with a shield that shuts them off. They came up with radar, and some guy comes up with a radar detector. All right, and so in these little ways, we beat City Hall. But the trick in beating City Hall is never break the law. Never break the law. And you never attack the law itself. See, the objective here, the objective is to comply with all of the laws and then beat your opponent at his own game without cheating, of course. Now, when you break the law, you cheat. That's what's going on. That's what's wrong with tax protest in general, is that it's cheating. And what you want is for your opponent to think you're cheating, but you're really not. And then when he attacks you with the law, he says, hey, this guy's breaking the law. Then you come in, oh, no, I'm not breaking the law. You made a mistake. You got the wrong guy here. And then you need to be able to prove that. And that's beating City Hall on their own terms. So complying with all of the laws is one of the prerequisites for beating City Hall and being successful at it time after time. Now, let me tell you a little story here about this thing of beating City Hall with what we call the front man. The front man. Oftentimes, you'll need somebody who can fill in for you in a business transaction or some kind of a business deal. So let me start off and tell you a little story about an escapade that I had some years ago and how that's worked for other people and how they beat City Hall by simply using the law with somebody else and then do it in such a way that you completely comply with all the laws. There are these loopholes in the law. There's always some loophole that's written into every law. See, the guy that writes the law doesn't want to get caught in his own spider web. So he puts into the law some kind of an escape clause. You just need to be crafty and careful as you code plead these statutes, looking for these escape clauses that have been written into the law for the benefit of the lawmaker who made the law. Now, let me give you an illustration of that one first. I had a student one time out in California. A burglar breaks into his house. He picks up his 45. He slips on his pants. Now, all he's got on is his pants. He's barefoot. He doesn't have a shirt on, so he's bare-chested. He walks downstairs. He surprises the burglar. The burglar bolts and runs through the back door with my student in hot pursuit. He chases the burglar down the alley and for a couple of blocks. Now, it's 2 o'clock in the morning or 3 or 4 or something like that. Now, here's this guy 2 or 3 blocks from home. The burglar got away. He didn't shoot at him. He had a gun in his hand. He sticks the gun in his back pocket and he starts to walk home. Now, it's 4 o'clock in the morning. He's almost buck naked, except he's got his pants on. And he's walking home in his bare feet. And here comes Ranger Rick on patrol. Ranger Rick, you know, the guy with the sign on the door that says, "We're here to protect and serve." Well, they're not lying to you. When you see the police car that says, "We're here to protect and serve," they are. They're there to protect and serve corporate business and government. They're just not there to protect and serve you, as is illustrated here. So Ranger Rick stops this guy and he says, "Hey, what are you doing?" So he tells him the story. He says, "Well, I live down the street over here, and this guy was in my house, and I chased him down the street, and he got away." Now, you'd think the cop would say, "Well, listen, partner, get in the car. Let me take you back home." No. The cop says, "Well, wait a minute. Where's the gun?" And so he pulls it out of his back pocket. Now, the cop arrests this guy for carrying a concealed weapon. Well, what more would you expect from a cop? He arrests this guy who's been victimized by a burglar who's trying to catch the burglar. But you know, the cop's right. You see, the guy isn't in his home. This is in California. He's out on the street with a gun in his back pocket at 4 o'clock in the morning. But you see, wouldn't you take into consideration that this guy's a homeowner? He lives down the street and he was chasing a burglar who was committing a crime. And well, as it turned out, this guy goes and he hires a lawyer, and the lawyer persuades him to plead guilty. And he goes in, plea bargains it out, pleads guilty, pays a $400 fine or something on that order. Now, the $400 fine goes to the city, doesn't it? Well, 10% goes to the state, 90% goes to the city, and that helps pay the policeman's salary and wages and fringe benefits and retirement and all that. In other words, it's a fine that the homeowner, that the taxpayer has to pay to the police, to the city, to the state, to the government, to protect and serve. Now, we look at that and we say, "Oh, my God, that's really bad." So this guy gets a little later on, you know, he goes through my school, he gets to looking at the statute, and he says, "Oh my God, there's two loopholes in the law." Now, I don't know if the law is still like this is 20 years ago, but take a look in California, if you're from California, and indeed take a look at your concealed weapon statute in your state, and see what the exceptions are. And maybe these exceptions might be just what you're looking for. But anyway, here are the two exceptions at that time in California. First, if you had a bank deposit that you were making, and you were on your way to or on your way back from the bank, in making a deposit, you can carry a concealed weapon without a permit. Second, if you're on a fishing trip and you've got a valid California fishing license and you're going fishing, you can carry a concealed weapon to and from your fishing expedition. Evidently, the legislators figured that there might be some need for carrying a concealed weapon. Now, you see, the legislators wrote into the law these two exceptions. And so the trick is, well, whenever you're traveling with a concealed weapon, you want to make sure you got your valid California fishing license and a fishing pole in the car or the pickup. So if you ever get stopped by the cops or something comes up, you say, "Well, I'm on my way to," or "I'm on my way back from fishing," or "I'm on my way to," or "on my way back from making this deposit at the bank," which means that you got to have a bank deposit sitting alongside you in the seat of the car. All right, now there's a couple of examples of how the law works against you, and you say to yourself, "God, I'd like to beat them at their own game." You see that, and it just really makes you angry. You know, you say, "Well, I want to do something about that." Well, I had a student one time by the name of Larry, who was a trader. And Larry had gotten into some trouble in his earlier days, and he had he had at least one felony conviction. He'd been convicted for a felony, served some time in the pen, got out. And, you know, by now he's 45, 50 years old and, you know, living his life and doing his thing. And one day he discovers this real neat deal. He's a trader, and he finds this auto auction down in Dallas, Texas. And he can get into an insurance auto auction, which is just for dealers. just auto dealers can go to this auction. And they bid on totaled out cars that the insurance companies have totaled out, and they buy them for pennies on the dollar. One car he bought, for instance, was a 98 Jeep Cherokee. And it had been in a carport next to a house that had caught on fire, and the vehicle was smoke damaged. Now, this car is about 2 years old, and it's worth about, in good condition, it's worth about $20,000. But it's smoke damaged, and so Larry bought this car for $4,500, I think it was, at the auction, spent $800 to have a car auto detailer air it out, clean it up, and he turned around and sold it for around $18,000. Gave a good discount on it, sold it for cash, and all he had in it was the $4,500 plus another $1,000 or so. So those are pretty lucrative deals, aren't they? And Larry now, in order to get into this auto auction, has to have an auto dealer's license. Well, here in Missouri, you have to pass a test and a background check and one thing and another if you want to be an auto dealer, and you can't have any felonies on your record. So Larry is out, O-U-T, dead on arrival. Can't get an auto dealer's license because he's got this felony. So here comes the front man story. He needs somebody that can fill in as a front. So he goes down to Arkansas, which is from where we live here, just down the road, a hop, skip, and a jump to Mountain Home. And he has a buddy down there who's in the air conditioning and refrigeration business. And he says, Tom, how would you like to get an auto dealer's license? And Tom is sitting there going, what the hell would I do with an auto dealer's license? And Larry says, well, Tom, if you would get an auto dealer's license, you could get into the Dallas auction, the insurance company closed auction, which is only for auto dealers. And Tom says, yeah, but I don't know anything about cars. And Larry says, well, I do. And you could hire me to go down there to the auto auction as your agent. See, an auto dealer can hire a convicted felon to work for him in his dealership. It's just that the licensed dealer himself can't be a convicted felon. So Tom goes down and passes the test, pays the money, and becomes an auto dealer. Now, of course, the guy that pays for this, time, effort, and energy, is Larry, isn't it? And Tom doesn't want to go to Dallas and bid on automobiles. And Larry just needs Tom to be the paper front. You know, it's Tom's used cars. And he doesn't have to have a used car lot. All he has to have is the license. He can sell cars out of his carport, or he can sell them on the street or wherever he wants to. So now Larry goes down and buys the cars, brings them back, details them out, fixes them up, sells them, and makes pretty healthy profits. And, of course, he pays his front man for the use of the license, you know, whatever they agree to. And I don't know what the private agreement is, but, you know, he probably pays him a few $100 or a few $1,000 a year for the use of his license. And there's an example of a front man and how a front man can be of value to you in your business transactions in all kinds of ways. You know, maybe you're a convicted felon, and that might be just the thing that you need to help you in your business career. You need somebody who isn't a convicted felon, who doesn't know how to do this particular kind of business. Now, here's an example. Back in 1981, we were closing out a company, a corporation, of which I happened to be an officer at the time, and so we had a lot of things that we needed to sell. We're closing out the inventory in the business, and we're closing out all the machinery and equipment and dies, and, you know, everything goes floor to ceiling, wall to wall, regardless of cost, loss, or value. Now, it happens that the corporation, which is a separate entity from the officers that run this company, and because these corporations are separate entities, you have to be very careful about how you deal, like a Martha Stewart with this insider trading thing she got convicted for. Actually, she didn't get convicted for insider trading. She got convicted for lying to an officer, which was kind of dumb on her part, you know, because when the officer came in and said, well, Mrs. Stewart, I'd like to ask you some questions, if she had asked two questions first. First question is, if I answer any of these questions, could the answers that I give you be used in any way against me in a criminal prosecution? And the policeman's going to say, well, yes or no. If the answer is no, well, then I don't want to talk to you because I want to maintain my own privacy and I want to protect my Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights, and I want counsel present before I answer any questions. Or if he says yes, then she says, then I don't want to answer any of your questions because I'm the target of a criminal investigation for which I want to apply my Miranda rights. So she ought not to have said anything, and had she followed that rule, if you want to avail yourself of the Fifth Amendment, then you have to keep your mouth shut. She elected to talk to the policeman because she wasn't the target of the investigation, but she wanted to protect her friend, and so she lied to the policeman. Well, gosh, kids, that's called perjury. Perjury is a separate crime. Now, she wasn't being investigated for perjury. She was being investigated for insider trading. And there wasn't anything that she said to the policeman that she couldn't have said to the jury for the first time when she got on the witness stand. But, you know, for whatever reason, she decided to talk. And when she talked, she lied. And when she lied, she got caught. And when she got caught, she got prosecuted. And when she got prosecuted, she got convicted. And when she got convicted, she paid some time. Okay, that's the way life is. So you got to be careful that you obey all the laws all the time. So when you're dealing in corporate capacity, you leave yourself open to all kinds of laws and rules and regulations that you wouldn't even be subject to if you were operating as a sole proprietor or Joe Sixpack. And that's the dilemma that I found myself in many, many years ago, is that I was an officer of a corporation, And the corporation, as an entity, had bought some light bulbs. And these light bulbs were kind of expensive. They, as I recall, they were around $3 a piece for the light bulbs, maybe a little more. But they were unusual light bulbs. See, the problem with the factory that we were in is it had these incandescent light bulbs, and there was lots of these fixtures, and it was a three-story building, and when you ran one of these carts or dollies across the floor upstairs, it would shake the floor. Well, when it shook the floor, it would shake the light bulb filaments. And these little cheap light bulbs that you buy down at Safeway, you know, and in the lighting stores, those light bulbs are designed to last for about 750 hours. And in fact, it says right on there, 750-hour light bulb. Well, then there's a light bulb, same wattage, 100 watts, but it's designed for long life, And they put heavier filaments in it. And it's a much stronger light bulb, and it lasts 7,000 hours. Instead of 700, it's 7,000, so it's 10 times longer. And these light bulbs actually will last two or three times longer than that. You know, you put a light bulb in, and it doesn't last just 700 hours. Sometimes it lasts 14, 21, 28, or 3,500 hours. Well, same thing with these heavy-duty light bulbs. But these heavy-duty light bulbs are special order, and you got to buy them by the case. So we bought these light bulbs by the case, and we had about, I don't know, six cases of these light bulbs left over. Now, there's 96 bulbs to a case, and they're $3 a piece. Let me see how many we got here. 3 times 96. That's about 288 bucks a case. And let's say it's rounded off to $300 a case. Now, we have approximately 6 or 8 cases of these. I forgot exactly, but I guess it's about 8 cases. So 3 times 8, about 2,400 bucks worth of light bulbs here. So you get these $2,400 worth of light bulbs stacked up over here, and we mark these in this closing out of business sale at $3 a piece. Actually, we just want to get our money out of them. I mean, that's all we're really after. But you can buy one of these cheap John light bulbs down at Safeway, 700-hour light bulb, 100 watts, for 75 cents. Now, you know, when you look at light bulb, 75 cents, and light bulb, $3, and 100-watt light bulb, you know, the average guy looks at that and says, hey, I'm going to buy the 75-cent light bulb. So the light bulb sat there on the floor, and they languished. One day, a guy comes in, and he says, George, what do you want for those light bulbs? And I said, $3 a piece. And he said, George, you dummy, you can't sell those light bulbs for $3 a piece. I mean, you know, come on, be intelligent. Those light bulbs, you can buy them all day long down at the store, you know, for 75 cents. So I explained to him what I just told you. And he looked at me and he said, so you think Bessie Ballmortal comes in here and gives a rat's, you know what? And he said, how many light bulbs have you sold? And I said, well, so far, none. And he says, yeah, you've been in the sale for 2 weeks. You got a 3-week sale. You've been in it for 2 weeks. You ain't sold a single light bulb. He says, I'll tell you what I'm going to do, George. I will write you a check right now for $300 and buy all of those light bulbs and take them off your hands and solve your problem for you. And I said, my God, we paid $3,000 for those light bulbs. $3,000. And now you want to come in here and offer us 10 cents on the dollar. And I said, now that's kind of unreasonable. And he says, okay, well, then sit on them. And when your sale closes and you got these 8 cases of light bulbs sitting over here and $3,000, and you know, you could have sold them for $300 and got something rather than nothing. You know, remember, you know, it was you that did it. And I said, well, you know, I'm listening to you here, Tom. And so I said, well, okay, Tom, I'll tell you what I'll do. You write me a check for $300 right now, pay me cash, and you take the light bulbs out. So he wrote me a check, and I took the check over, and I stamped the back of it, for deposit only, Atlantis Manufacturing Company. I mean, you got to do this legally. You got to dot all your I's and cross all your T's, especially when you're working, you know, like Martha Stewart buying and selling stocks. I mean, you're working in a corporation like Ken Lay running Enron. And let me tell you, you know, just in passing over here, let me tell you that the chief executive officer of a company probably knows less about what's going on in that company than the secretary does. I'm an old-timey corporate executive, and now let me tell you, boy, am I glad I'm out of that trap. That's a trap. You see, the company controller takes care of the books, and you as the CEO, you believe the reports that come from bookkeeping, accounting, and the company controller. If you, honest to God, boys and girls, if you believe that Ken Lay, the head of Enron, is counting the money that comes in and goes out, you don't understand corporate business at all. None. Zero. Hell, the CEO... as the CEO of Atlantis, for instance, the controller would come in. The secretary writes up the payroll checks. The controller comes in, sets them down in front of me, and I sign all those payroll checks. Honest to God, did you think that I made the deductions and that I know how much is going out to the IRS in the form of payroll taxes? I don't know any more than what I'm told by the powers that be. Each office in the company, you know, they have their duties and responsibilities. But you see, the law says the CEO is ultimately responsible. When the ship hits the iceberg, the captain is asleep in his bunk. But he's the guy that takes the rap, even though the first officer was at the wheel. Okay, so you need to understand that when you're in a corporate capacity, boy, you got all these rules and regulations, and you can get burned by them. So you got to be very, very careful about how you play this game, because there's laws, rules, and regulations that are made by the legislature every day. And you know, who's the average guy that's picking up the statute books and reading all the statutes? You know that OSHA, the EPA, or the legislature is enacting today. Well, not if you're running a business. I mean, you know. If you're a lawyer, you might read them, but not a businessman. All right, so now I rang it up in the cash register, I wrote a receipt, and I took the check and stamped it for deposit only. Now, I'm the guy that signed the check for $3,000 and sent it off to the Sylvania company when we bought the light bulbs. I authorized the purchase. I spent the money, the corporate money. I had the power to do that, and I did it. Now, I've got the corporate power to sell the light bulbs. And this is a bad deal. I mean, I don't deny it. You know, it's a bad deal. You know, when you buy something for $3,000 and sell it for $300, that's not good economics. That's a bad business transaction. And I don't deny it. I was a bad businessman, and of course, that's why I'm out of the business world now, because I was obviously a bad businessman. And Ken Lay, you know, he was a bad businessman, and he's out of the business world. Unfortunately for him, he's on his way to prison. And fortunately for me, I obeyed all the laws, you know, at least in this transaction. So I sold the light bulbs, and I took the $300 check, and I put it in the deposit, and I dutifully made up the deposit, and I took it up to the bank, and I deposited it in the account. So that, you know, if at any time in the future the government comes after me, or the IRS, or EPA, or anybody, I can identify exactly how that business transaction came down. There's nothing wrong with that business transaction. It's a normal, ordinary, everyday, garden variety business transaction. All right, albeit it was a bad one for the company. Well, the next day, Tom comes back in, and he is in tears. He is just really beside himself, and he said to me, my wife is going to divorce me because I bought those light bulbs. Yeah, he said, Mary said that she's going to divorce me buying, you know, 8 or 10 cases of light bulbs and you know, for $300, and I threw our money away, and she was just ticked off, and she was going to divorce him. And so he said, George, I brought the light bulbs back, and I need you to take the light bulbs back and refund my money. So I pointed up on the wall, and I said, Tom, I said, all sales final, no cash refunds. All sales final, no cash refunds. Now, those are the terms and conditions of the sale, and it was a cash transaction, and I sold them, and you know, now I can't do it. And he said, well, she's going to divorce me, and he was in tears, and nothing worse than a man crying in your office. And I said, Tom, okay, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to take the old maid off your hands. And so I reached in my pocket, and I pulled out $300 of my money. And I said, okay, I'll buy the damn light bulbs from you. Deliver them to my house and put them in my garage. So I bought Tom's light bulbs. Now, I'm on the hook. See, it's kind of like playing old maid, you know. And now I've got the old maid in my hand, and it's like dog poop on your shoe. You know, how do you get it off? You know, it's easy to get on, but it's hard to get off. And so here I'm stuck with the damn light bulbs. So I came home that night, and my wife she's upset, and she's excited. She said, what in the world is this guy? He knocked on the door, says that you told him to deliver these light bulbs, and I told him, put them in the garage, and there they are, messing up the garage and taking up space, and you know that they're ugly eyesores. They were kind of ugly bulbs. They use them in traffic lights, you know. The cities buy them, you know, and the industrial users, and you stick them in the traffic lights, and they last for 7,000 hours or 20 or 30 or 50,000, whatever they last. And so, but they're ugly looking things. I mean, you know, they're not frosted, and they're not shaped nicely, you know, they're just kind of ugly. And she just was really upset about that, and she says, now how much did you pay for those? And I told her $300, and she says, you dummy, you stupid nitwit, you nincompoop. And so my wife is wanting to divorce me now because I bought these damn light bulbs. And so anyway, I'm stuck with the light bulbs, and they're sitting in my garage, and I own them now. So next day, an old buddy of mine comes up from Salt Lake City, and he's kind of crying the blues, and he says, I'm facing bankruptcy. And I says, well, what happened, Friar? And he said, I got this old warehouse down on Fifth South, and in the warehouse, I got the second story. And when you run a dolly across the second story up here, it shakes the floor. And then on the first floor down here, the light bulbs, you know, they get to shaking, and it knocks the filaments out, and we're constantly replacing light bulbs. And he said, I'm just beside myself with what I'm going to do. I go down to Safeway, cost me 75 cents, and I buy a light bulb, and I stick it in there, and a week later, the damn thing is out, and it's just a nightmare. And I said, boy, this is your lucky day. Talk about your lucky day. So I said, now I've got these light bulbs, and I've got them for $1,500. I've got about 8 or 10 cases of these bulbs. They were originally purchased by Atlantis Manufacturing Company for $3,000, and they were sold and subsequently resold, and I'm now in possession of them, and I have them, and I'm prepared to sacrifice those light bulbs for a paltry $1,500 or 50 cents on the dollar. And they're 7,000 hours, so get this. You're going to pay $3 or $3.50 for these light bulbs brand new. But you can get these light bulbs now while supplies last for only $1.50, which is double what you're paying down at the grocery store, but they last 10 times longer, so you're actually making 5 times return on your invested capital. Invest $1,500, and you're going to make $15, $30, $45, $60, $7,500 return over time. And he said, George, you have saved my business. As he reached in his pocket and peeled off 15 Benjis for me, and I sold the light bulbs and passed the old maid on to this fool from Salt Lake City. Now, there's the intelligent use of a front man in a bad business transaction. Okay, so sometimes You can beat City Hall, the FBI, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and corporate laws and rules and regulations that apply to your company by simply using the expedience of what's normally called in modern circles today a straw man, but incorrectly so. The correct term is called a front man, because a straw man, when you look up the definition in Bouvier's, is a paid professional perjured witness. That's what a straw man is. All right, let's take a little break right here, and then let me give you a reminder that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. Now, if you'd like more information about the law school and the law hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. And keep in mind that the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. And the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through our website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call the Law School Direct at 417-273-4967. While we're on the subject of straw men, now let me tell you a story about a case that came down called Wickard versus Filburn. Wickard versus Filburn. Decided back about 1943, in which a farmer needed a front man, but he didn't avail himself of a front man, and as a result of that, he lost a case. He was swallowed up by City Hall. And as it turns out, Mr. Filburn is a farmer over in Indiana. About 1938, the government came along with one of these neat programs. You ever notice how government comes along with neat programs? They come along with this neat program, and they offer it to certain members of the public, in this case, farmers. It's called the Farm Subsidy Program. And they come along and they say, well, would you like us to tax a lot of people living in New York City and Los Angeles and Seattle and take their money away from them by the heavy hand of the police power of the state and come over here and give it to you, Mr. Filburn? And Mr. Filburn said, that sounds like a hell of a good idea. I like the idea of the government using guns and batons and the police power of the state to go out and take money away from people in other locations and then bring it halfway across the country and deliver it to me at my farm. I like that idea. And Mr. Filburn was hooked. Filburn, like all of us, is motivated by vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. The people in New York, Los Angeles, and Seattle, motivated by fear of the batons and guns of the police power of the state, forked over their money to the state's agents. Now, Mr. Filburn, motivated by lust and greed, agreed to take that money from these same agents of the state upon certain specified conditions. So in 1938, Mr. Filburn went down and signed his name to a contract, which was put out by the Department of Agriculture. Now keep in mind that the Department of Agriculture employs a lot of lawyers, and that Mr. Filburn did not write this contract. Instead, Mr. Filburn accepted the contract that had been written by lawyers working for the Department of Agriculture. And if you've noticed, when you go down to buy something at Best Buy and you're asked to sign a consumer contract, please keep in mind that you don't write these contracts. They're written for you by Best Buy. Remember that. These are called adhesion contracts. They're a take-it-or-leave-it contract. Well, now, the going price for wheat back in 1938 was about 4 bits. That's called 50 cents a bushel. But the government offered to pay 96 cents a bushel, 46 cents more, nearly double, if he would sign this contract and agree in the contract that he wouldn't plant any more than 20 acres. So Mr. Filburn, I guess, had been planting and harvesting 20 acres of wheat for a long time. It could well be, like many of these government boondoggles, that Mr. Filburn had never planted an acre of wheat in his life, went down, signed up for the program, and then started planting wheat so he could get the added subsidy. I don't know what the exact details were, but in any event, Mr. Filburn signed the contract. And this case is reported in the U.S. Supreme Court reports. It's called Wickard versus Filburn. Wickard versus Filburn. Wickard is the Secretary of Agriculture. And time goes on, and Mr. Phil Byrne plants his 20 acres and harvests it and sells it to the government and gets his 96 cents a bushel. This is good business. Unlike George Gordon, who does bad business and writes checks for $3,000 and then sells the stuff for $300, Mr. Phil Byrne, he goes out and plants this wheat, and instead of selling it on the conventional market for 50 cents, he sells it to the government for 96. Now, that's good business. So Mr. Phil Byrne does this in 1938, 39, 40, 41. And he's just raking in the bucks from all of you scaredy cats and you people motivated by fear, paying your income taxes in New York, Los Angeles, and Seattle. And he's reaping these benefits in this transfer of wealth from you city folks to these country folks. And everybody's happy. Government's happy. Department of Agriculture's happy. Police are happy. Taxpayers are happy. And farmers are happy. Everybody is happy. And everybody's voting the straight Democratic ticket back in the Depression year. So time goes on, and Mr. Philburn wakes up one day, and he decides that he's going to plant 40 acres of wheat. 40. Now, that's double his allotment. And he does. He goes out, and he plants 40 acres of wheat. And then just like he normally does every year, he sells 20 acres of that wheat to the government. And the other 20 acres, he doesn't sell. He didn't sell that wheat at all. He fed it to his turkeys. Got that? Fed it to his turkeys. Now, here's a guy that intends to beat City Hall. And after all, the law says that you can grow wheat, but you've got to keep your wheat on this allotment of 20 acres. You can't plant 30 or 40 acres. Phil Byrne construes that, well, I can't plant 30 or 40 acres and then sell that to the government, but I'm going to plant 40 acres, but I'm only going to sell 20 acres to the government, and the other 20 acres I'm going to feed to my turkeys, and then I'll sell the turkeys, and then I'll get paid for that meat. So I'm going to convert 20 acres of wheat into turkey meat and then convert that into profit and gain, put that in my bank account. And that's what he did. Well, Mr. Wickard, who's now the head of the Secretary of Agriculture, the head of the Department of Agriculture, he doesn't like that. So he sues Mr. Phil Byrne, and he wants Phil Byrne to pay the fines and all of the applicable costs of the day to the government for the breach of contract. Now, Phil Byrne goes into the courts and he says, wait a minute, this is America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, and I'm sure he was wearing an American flag in his lapel. And he said, besides that, I didn't break any laws. I only grew 20 acres of wheat that I sold to the government. Any other wheat that I sell is free market wheat, and the free market and freedom. And you know how people talk about freedom, you know. So the Supreme Court came down with what we call a landmark decision in this case, and they ruled against Mr. Phil Byrne, and they said, it's hardly lack of due process or equal protection of the law for government to regulate that which it subsidizes. Do you follow that? It's hardly lack of due process or equal protection of the law for government to regulate that which it subsidizes. So if you want to get these subsidies from the government, if you want to sign contracts with the government's going to regulate that and construe and interpret the contract the way they want it. Now, the Supreme Court went on to say that the intent of the lawmaker was to regulate the amount of wheat grown and sold into the commercial stream of market or the commercial market. And that when he planted 40 acres of wheat, he actually put an extra 20 acres of wheat into the marketplace that he'd agreed by contract not to do. Now remember, Philburn's argument is, no, I didn't sell that wheat into commerce. I fed it to my turkeys. And the court came back and said, but if you hadn't grown that 20 acres, you'd have had to have gone into the market and bought that 20 acres of wheat to feed to your turkeys, which was the intent of Congress. So Phil Byrne loses, and from that we learn a lesson, that if you want to grow 40 acres of wheat, you can't grow 40 acres of wheat because that's against the law. You see, you got your farm over here, and you agreed that you're going to plant 20 acres. Now, if Mr. Phil Byrne had used his legal genius, assuming that he had some, he could have gone over to his neighbor and said, hey, neighbor, I would like to lease or rent 20 acres from you. Assuming, of course, that your farm is not signed up for some farm subsidy program. And then he could have planted 20 acres of wheat over here on the neighbor's farm, harvested that wheat and fed it to his turkeys, and he would have been in compliance with his contract. Or he could have gone to his neighbor and said, now, neighbor, I'd like to contract with you to grow this 20 acres of wheat, and here's the price I'm going to pay you. In other words, he needed a front. He needed somebody else to do business with who wasn't in the farm program, who could do the act that he had done, but he needed to have a separate transaction. He could have gone over to his neighbor and said, now, let me put my turkeys over here, or let me lease to you my turkey building over here, and you grow this wheat over here, and you feed these turkeys over here, then I'm going to lease you here in my building. He hadn't signed any deal with the government concerning turkeys now, remember? All right, so again, it's a case of you don't want to break the law. You want to use the law and the loopholes in the law. You know, oftentimes what isn't said is more eloquent than what is said. So you're looking for what does the law provide, but you're also looking for what is it that the law does not provide. Now, to show you about what the law does not provide, let me tell you a little story here about zoning and planning. Remember, I told you the other day about zoning and planning as it related to the Barrister's Inn School in Garden City, Idaho. But I had a student one time down in Anaheim, California, and he went through a divorce, and he had a warehouse, a big warehouse, and he had 20 or 30 employees working in this warehouse. You know, big trucks back up and unload, and there's an office, and in a big warehouse, a big business like this, it's located in an industrial park. Now, in big cities, they will oftentimes zone residential out of commercial. Now, remember, in the story in Garden City, Idaho, they did not zone residential out of commercial, but in Anaheim, California, they did. There's no living in a warehouse. You couldn't make your residence in a warehouse. So the student goes through a divorce. Now, he's living down the street, and he lives in a house, and that's his residence, but he and his wife get a divorce, and in the divorce, she gets the house and he gets the shaft. And so he's sitting there saying, well, where am I going to live? You know, paying alimony and child support. And then I don't have a house. And so it just so happens that down at the warehouse, there's a sick room with a bed, and there's bathrooms or restrooms, you know, for men and women. And there's a kitchen, you know, for making coffee. There's everything in this warehouse that you need for living. And so he thought, well, I'll just do this temporarily. Now, at that time, it's quite a few years ago, at that time, if he were to rent a house or an apartment, it was going to cost him $700 a month. Today, it's around $1,400. It's double that. But at this time, it was around $700 a month. And he thought, gee, I could save $700 a month by living in my warehouse, but it's against the law to live in my warehouse. I want to live in my warehouse, but I can't make this my residence. So what is it that makes your house your residence? So he goes down, he takes a look at the statutes of the city ordinance, and he has to comply with the rules and regulations of the city ordinance. So he has his mail, that is his personal private mail. Now, there's mail delivery here at the warehouse, but that's the company warehouse. He has his mail in a post office box down the street. Now, he has an automobile, but he has the automobile registered to his brother's residence, which is down the street. And he doesn't rent another house. Now, he doesn't have a house someplace else, but he signs an agreement with his brother that he will pay his brother $200 a month to rent a bedroom in his brother's house, which is down the street. So now, armed with his registration, is at his brother's house, and he's renting a room at his brother's house and for $200 a month and so on. He goes down to the warehouse, and one night, you know, when the warehouse closes, he decides he needs to work a little late, and so he works all night at the warehouse. And this goes on for quite a while, and there's a security police, and the security police are, you know, tooling around in the industrial park, and they note that this car is in the parking lot, and they note that this car is in the parking lot night after night after night after night after night. And so one day they go over and they knock on the door at the warehouse, and sure enough, this guy's there, and so he answers the door, and they say, well, sir, what are you doing here? And he says, well, I'm working late. And they said, well, we've been watching the warehouse, and we noticed that you work late every night. And he says, yeah, that's true. I work late at night. I'm a workaholic, and I work a lot. Well, it wasn't too much later until the city sent him notice, and they said, hey, listen, we're going to prosecute you for living in this warehouse. You're in violation of the zoning ordinance over here, and you can't live in this warehouse, and so on. And so the guy goes into court and presents his case. This is what courtroom strategy and procedure is all about, you know. Is he in violation of the law or not? So he comes in, and he brings in witnesses, evidence, and testimony. Witnesses, evidence, and testimony. And his witnesses testify that he, in fact, has a residence down the street with his brother, and he rents a bedroom and pays $200 a month and has his car registered down the street and gets his mail in a post office box. And that he's a workaholic and he works late. So he works 24 hours a day here at the warehouse. Now, the government came in and said, yeah, but. And he said, well, on cross-examination, he said, now, is there anything in the ordinance that prohibits a man from working there in the warehouse 24 hours a day? And I looked at the statute, and there isn't. And while I'm working in the warehouse 24 hours a day, can I use the men's bathroom in the warehouse? Yeah. And while I'm working at the warehouse, if I were to become sleepy or tired, could I go into the nurse's office or the nurse's room, the sick bay, and lay down on the bed if I had a bad headache or something? And could I do that? Well, yeah, I guess you could do that. If we could do that at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, could we do that at 3 o'clock in the morning? Well, yeah, I guess you could. And so when you take a look at what is a residence, and you take a look at the ordinance and the statute, and you use a front man. Now, did he ever sleep in his brother's bedroom? I don't know. I never did ask the guy that. Did he actually pay his brother $200 a month for the use of that bedroom? I don't know. I presume he did. He testified to that fact. I assume he did. It was a good deal for him, $200 a month. He's got a bedroom. He got an address with a registration on his car. And he's not establishing here at the warehouse the necessary indicia for creating a domicile or a residence. He is creating at his warehouse paid receipts. And these paid receipts show that he's got a warehouse and a business. his paid receipts and his record show that he has employees that come to work and that he comes to work, and that he comes and goes. He gets in his car and he leaves from time to time. He might leave at 7 o'clock at night and come back at midnight and go to work again from midnight until 6 in the morning. He might leave at 6 in the morning, and he might go somewhere and do something during the day and come back at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. There wasn't anything there that said that he couldn't run that warehouse and trucks couldn't come in and leave at 24 hours a day, or that he couldn't do business 24 hours a day, or that he couldn't be there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The prohibition was against making it your residence or living there. Well, what constitutes living there? I mean, picture this. You know, you're working for General Motors, and you go to work at the factory, and you go to your office, and you're working there at the factory doing your thing in your office, and 6 o'clock comes, and instead of going home, you stay there all night, and you work until 6 o'clock in the morning, and then you go home. Would that prove that you were living there at your office at General Motors? Well, no. What if you did that 2 nights? Would that prove you're living there, or that's your residence? Well, no. We'll just keep adding days to it. What if you did that 365 days a year? You know, the guy comes in and testifies to the fact that I've got a residence down the street. I'm renting a bedroom from my brother. What if he didn't rent a bedroom from his brother, but he slept under a bridge? What if he didn't live in Anaheim? What if he lived in Los Angeles and commuted? What if he lived in San Francisco and flew into work every day? Here again, the use of a front to comply with the law, like a Martha Stewart could have and probably should have, or like this guy I just told you about, or like the light bulb story, or like Larry, you know, the guy with the auto auction, you know, from time to time, it's just real neat and real advantageous, as Mr. Filburn could have done and didn't do, to have somebody else do the actual business transaction, and then you have a second or a third or a fourth layer contract protected at Article 1, Section 10, which protects your right to contract. All right, we're about out of time. I'm going to have to leave it right there. I have to remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. Now, if you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening. Good night, friends.